Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see something.
Produced in the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The Prison Journalism Project is an independent, national nonprofit organization that trains incarcerated people to be writers and journalists and publishes their stories so they can serve as influential voices in the broader conversation about prison and the criminal legal system in their local communities and across the nation. I sat down recently to have a conversation via Zoom with Mason Bryan, senior editor at the Prison Journalism Project, to talk about their work and particularly their Locked Out project on voting, politics, and democracy behind bars. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, on December 3rd, Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt released the 2024 Multnomah County Corrections Grand Jury Report. Oregon state law requires an annual grand jury inquiry into the condition and management of every adult and youth correctional facility in the county. These include the Multnomah County Detention Center and the Multnomah County Inverness Jail, which are both operated by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, the Donald E. Long Juvenile Justice Center, which is operated by the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice Juvenile Division, and the Columbia River Correctional Institution, which is operated by the Oregon Department of Corrections. Briefly from the executive summary, quote, "The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has experienced many difficult years surrounding staffing and facilities. The Multnomah County jail system is in crisis and at risk of jeopardizing public health and safety. All stakeholders expressed frustrations with the compounding effects of the ongoing MCSO staffing shortages. The criminal justice system is also severely impacted by the shortage of court-appointed attorneys for people charged with crimes. The buildings and facilities that house Multnomah County jails, in particular MCDC, are rapidly deteriorating. They are not adequately addressing the population's mental health and substance abuse needs." End quote. The Corrections Grand Jury made priority recommendations in the areas of staffing, mental health and substance use disorder services, transitional housing, attorney access, communication, and replacement facilities. Regarding that last item on replacement facilities, the grand jury report recommends that the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office must initiate a feasibility study to replace their two aging jails, the Detention Center and the Inverness Jail, quote, "with a goal of identifying a location that could consolidate operations into one facility," end quote. The report also recommends that the Sheriff's Office prioritize best practices of rehabilitative and restorative justice in the replacement facilities. A copy of the full Multnomah County Corrections Grand Jury Report is available via the Multnomah County DA Office's website. That URL is mcda.us. Now for my conversation with Mason Bryan, senior editor at the Prison Journalism Project.
It's nice to be here, Doug. I appreciate it. My name is Mason Bryan. I'm a senior editor at an organization called the Prison Journalism Project. We are a group that works with incarcerated writers across the country. We train folks inside in the craft of journalism and publish their stories. We have an education arm and a publishing arm, and our organization is aimed at trying to change the conversation around mass incarceration in this country and make sure that people who are most affected by the criminal legal system and criminal legal policies and the criminal legal public discourse are involved meaningfully and robustly in that debate. So that's a little bit about our organization.
Now tell us a bit about yourself. You are what I would refer to as a proper journalist. I mean, how'd you get into journalism?
Yeah, I suppose I'm a proper journalist. I started journalism in high school. I worked for my high school newspaper in New Mexico, and that's where I got the itch. It became clear to me that journalism was a craft in which you could get paid to ask questions, read and write. And these things, as I was sort of leaving high school and going into college were pretty exciting to me. And I did some journalism in college. I worked for an English language newspaper in Santiago, Chile. I worked for my college newspaper And then pretty soon after I graduated, I started working for an organization in Washington State called Crosscut at the time. It's now called Cascade PBS. And there I sort of started my career in earnest and worked as a editorial assistant, did some reporting. And then my last job there was as an opinion editor. So I worked with columnists and op-ed contributors. And that was the job I had before I came to Prison Journalism Project. And I've been here for, it'll be about 3 years next year.
I want to find out more about the kind of work you're doing, training folks, and I think it's, you know, having the real world experience and having that having journalism as a passion, it must be tremendous. But before we get to that, before we get more into generally about the PJP, I brought you in to talk about this locked out project that that you folks have been doing. Felony disenfranchisement is. It's stupid, it's dumb, it's evil, and it's wrong. It's the thing we do to punish people beyond just throwing them in a cage and treating them like animals. We take away their rights as a citizen of the country and take away their right to franchise, their right to vote, their right to have a say in their futures. And people do get out, and even when they aren't out, they should still have rights. And to talk about jails, so many people who haven't even been convicted. And I'll stop ranting. See, this is why I have to write a script, because otherwise I start ranting. So let's go back to the original. Tell us about the Locked Out Project.
So ahead of the presidential election that we had in November, the editors at PJP were interested in exploring the issue of voting and democracy and politics more broadly behind bars. You know, we wanted to know, how do folks inside think about democracy? As you mentioned in your question, the vast majority of people who are incarcerated are disenfranchised. They've lost the right to vote once they've gone to prison. And so because this election was going to be, you know, as consequential as all the ones before it, maybe more so, we thought it was a good time to ask folks inside about this. And so we invited a number of contributors who have written for us and new contributors questions about how they felt about voting behind bars or about not being able to vote behind bars. We asked writers what their opinions were about politics. Do they follow politics? Are they interested? What kind of issues are important to them? We asked writers about what prison has taught them about politics and democracy, received a number of interesting answers. And we asked writers, you know, what does disenfranchisement do for your sense of civic spirit and your sense of whether democracy matters? And well, we had a range of really interesting responses from writers all over the country, and we published a little over 10 essays and a handful of mini pieces. Just before the election this year.
Yeah, I was curious, getting ready for this, to know what the election was like for people who are incarcerated. I mean, it's such a massive experience. There was an article on that very subject. Tell us if you could about this piece in particular. It's what it's like watching the 2024 presidential race from prison, by Ramel Kamik.
Yeah, Ramel is a writer incarcerated in California. Has written a few stories for us. He's a very lyrical writer. But he submitted this story. We didn't ask for it. It came to our submission mail, and we were really glad to see it. But you know, it's a very short slice of life story about the experience in his facility of watching his section, his pod, watch the election unfold. So, you know, watching the news, watching the debate, watching Trump get shot in the ear, all of this, he sort of recounts, like I said, a slice of what that was like. And, you know, people may have various ideas or conceptions about, you know, how people behind bars feel about politics, but it's not so complicated. I mean, incarceration, prison life is a world full of humans. And in any world full of humans, there is a vast array of political opinion. There's a vast array of interest in politics. There's just a vast diversity. behind bars, just like outside in the free world. So what Rommel's piece, I think, underscores is that, people inside are just like people outside. They have a range of views about politics. They watch cable news for entertainment. They get a big, they get a kick out of the fights. Whereas, some people, of course, take politics more seriously and recognize that people behind bars are affected by the things that politicians say, the things that politicians do, and they take that seriously. That was one of the lessons of Locked Out, is that, people behind bars, if they are interested in politics and they do, they take the vote seriously, they come to have a more, maybe appreciate the vote more, have a deeper appreciation for the sanctity of the vote, of what it means to have a voice in a democracy. Now, not everyone feels that way. Some folks behind bars, think voting is one of many civic actions that one should do. Other people think that voting isn't going to do anything. We had one piece in the project, sociologist that Ohio State University talked to his cousin, who was incarcerated in Louisiana. Him and most of his family was incarcerated. In fact, 50. Around 50 of this guy's relatives have been incarcerated at some point in his family's life. And his cousin talked about the experience of civic disenfranchisement. So it's one thing to, be locked out from the vote, to not have the right to vote, but it's another to experience the sort of grinding, systematic, corrosive effect that being excluded from politics has on your sense, on your sense of your political self. So for this guy, talking to his cousin, the sociologist, he said, I voting's important, but what's it going to do for me? Is it going to help me get a job now that I'm out? Is it going to help me, get housing now that I'm out? And there was a real sense of resignation, and understandably so, I think. So anyway, a range of feeling about the election and politics inside, for sure.
And that one, the one you just mentioned, is that was by T Professor Terence Hinton, right? As told to nearly 50 of my relatives have been incarcerated. That was one of your first articles in the Locked Out series, and as I note here, it was part of U.S. Democracy Day, a nationwide collaborative on September 15th, the International Day of Democracy. There is so much great work on the PJP site. The website URL, of course, is prisonjournalismproject.org. I was looking at a few, and I was wondering, could you, if you tell me a bit about some of these pieces and about some of the authors? This one, for example, from October of this year, and I think this was about from your Locked Out project. And it's "Do People in Prison Have a Right to be Heard?" by Jeffrey McKee.
This is one of the more interesting essays in the Locked Out Project, I think. It's a piece by a writer named Jeffrey McKee, who's incarcerated in Washington State. He's been a contributor to PJP for about as long as we've been in existence, about 4 years. And this is a writer who has had very little writing experience before he started contributing to PJP, and has really grown as a writer and a journalist through his work inside. He's written some really moving pieces. He's also written some funny pieces, some really light pieces. Yeah, he has a piece about smuggling a plant into prison, which is pretty comical. So Jeffrey McKee wrote a piece for Locked Out that I think really speaks to the heart of the project. Jeffrey explains in the essay that, when you get into prison, there's an orientation, and the guards tell you the things you need to know. And one of the things that they say is that if you have a problem as an incarcerated person, there's a couple means of redress. There's a couple ways that you can articulate your complaint and get it addressed. And those two ways are through the grievance process. You have a problem, you fill out a slip, you submit it to the appropriate guard, and maybe or maybe not, your grievance will be considered and addressed. The other option that folks inside have to make their voice heard is through the courts. In order to do that, you have to, have access to a lawyer, or you have to be good at navigating the law yourself. In any event, there's a very high bar to accessing the courts as someone who's incarcerated. But Jeffrey McKee is a very smart guy, trained himself in the law, and has also been a serial grievance filer. Ever since he's been incarcerated, he has, encountered incidents of mistreatment, incidents of injustice, and other instances of sort of bad action on a part of, fellow incarcerated people, but in many cases on part of guards. And he has tried to do something about that. And the only thing that he can do about that is file grievances and file lawsuits. So in the piece, Jeff elaborates or details, the reasons why he's filed grievances and the reasons why he's filed lawsuits, and he talks a little bit about those. But his bigger takeaway is that in general, these processes, these systems are insufficient, that they don't actually often lead to material change for folks inside. In some ways, the grievance system is like a rubber stamp system that rarely, results in significant material change. And so Jeffrey sort of makes this painfully clear. And then he asks, could the vote help me? And Jeffrey isn't, doesn't have rose-colored glasses on about what the vote could or couldn't deliver for folks inside. But he does say, sort of from a spiritual level, that if he had the vote, he would at least be able to cast, to put his weight, to put his support, his vocal support behind someone who, if elected, would be in his corner. And there's not enough people, Jeff seems to argue, who are in the corners of incarcerated people. He says that maybe the vote would be one more tool in his tool chest, besides the courts and the grievance system, to make his voice heard. And I think Jeff's essay is a sober reflection and analysis of, of what it's like to try again and again and again to affect change within the system and being constantly frustrated in that effort. And so Jeff says, well, maybe the vote could help offer some relief.
This is my conversation with Mason Bryan, senior editor at the Prison Journalism Project. We'll hear the rest in a moment. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. So, tell me about Lockdown is just one of PJP's special projects. Tell me about some of the other work you and the project are doing.
One project I would point listeners to is a project we called The Grain of American Prisons. This we published in 2023. And it was a series of essays like the Locked Out Project that dealt with the issue of elderly folks behind bars. Longer prison sentences, a decreasing rate of parole being offered to folks inside has resulted in the number of people who are 55 and older climbing, from 48,000 people at one point to 154,000 over just the last 2 decades. Some of the most recent data that we have available is from 2019, and it suggests that this age cohort of 55 of folks 55 and older made up 63% of state prison deaths in 2019. And so this is an issue that has become more. This is an issue that's gained the attention of more journalists, more researchers, more folks concerned with the prison system. And so we wanted to take a look at what the experience of being old and aging behind bars was like. And you can imagine it's not pleasant to get old. There are pieces in this project about the health issues that one person developed while inside and how they got worse when they got out. People who have experienced, terrible healthcare behind bars. There's one essay in the piece that I remember fondly about a guy who became toothless in prison and his struggle to receive dental care. So it's again, it's a series of essays that speak to, a central issue, in this case, aging in prison. And I think it does a pretty good job at, showing a range of the experiences that folks have, men and women, growing old behind bars. So that's one. Another project that we're working on that's in the works right now and is sort of an extension of this aging project is the issue of cancer behind bars. Cancer is the leading death, a leading cause of death for people who are incarcerated. And the rates of cancer are higher for folks inside than they are for people in the free community. And it's a big issue. So like Locked Out, like the grain of American prisons, this project will also take a close look at a very specific slice of incarcerated life. And we're gonna, you know, we're asking questions about what it's like to receive cancer care behind bars, what it feels like to get a cancer diagnosis when you're incarcerated, how healthcare treatment works, you know, what it's like to be shackled and taken out of your cell and transported to a community hospital to receive care. In our early stages of reporting on this project, we've learned a lot about the problems that people face. Continuity of care is a huge issue. You know, getting appointments lined up and the logistics negotiated. It's just a lot harder to do when you're in prison than when you're out. So that's coming down the pike. We're looking forward to publishing that in the middle of next year sometime. One of the other projects that we'll be working on next year will have an emphasis on the experience of women behind bars. The rate of female incarceration has grown rapidly in the last few decades, much more than the rate of male incarceration. And while women make up a much smaller portion of the incarcerated population overall, we think that their experience before, during, and after incarceration can tell us a lot about the problems with the prison system and how to improve it for folks who are inside now. So we're gonna make a devoted effort to recruit women writers, explore the experience of prison for women. You know, prison is a place designed for men. So, you know, as you can imagine, it's not the most hospitable place for anyone, let alone for women. So you can look out for that next year sometime as well.
How can people keep up with the work that you and the Prison Journalism Project are doing? What's the website, social media, that kind of thing?
Yeah, if you Google Prison Journalism Project, we'll come up. Our link is prisonjournalismproject.org. You can type that in. We have a newsletter called The Inside Story, which comes out every Sunday. It's a great way to receive our stories and keep up to date with the happenings at BJP. And of course, you can follow us on Instagram, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Blue Sky, and also on X, at least for a little while.
So you're senior editor there. So that means you're working with a lot of people who are incarcerated and working with them as they develop their pieces. And well, you're obviously... For the center, you're helping with their training as journalists. What's that like? You have a cool job. What's it like?
I think it is a cool job. I think it's a great job, and I feel really lucky to have it. The work is never boring, and the work is often logistically challenging, but we have an organization that is staffed with some very smart people. We have a team called Writer Relations who is staffed completely by formerly incarcerated folks. So people who really understand what it's like to be in the system, what it's like navigating the system. And this team helps organize and manage all of our correspondence. We are receiving and sending thousands of messages every month, either through snail mail or through these digital communication platforms that folks inside have access to. Many of our submissions, our story submissions, come handwritten. They go to a mailbox, and then we sort through them one by one. The writer relations team does a first level of sorting, and then there are several other layers of sorting where editors go through stories, debate them, discuss them, talk about whether we can work with a story, how we think we can support a writer, where a writer's at in their training, that kind of thing. And once we've received the stories, then the work of, we have assigned the stories to editors rather, then the work of editing begins. And our editing approach at PJP, we take really seriously. Because we're working with folks inside, many of whom have not had significant or high quality access to meaningful education opportunities, folks who are living in traumatic environments, who may have significant histories of trauma, we take our communication with the writers really seriously for all of those reasons. And so we try to imagine as editors, what's it like to be in the shoes of someone inside? And, you know, how can we keep answers to that question? And there are many answers to that question, but how can we keep those at the forefront of our mind when we're editing folks inside? And from a nuts and bolts perspective, our system of editing involves two primary modes. One is we edit in brackets. So we'll literally take the text and we'll We'll insert in bracketed parentheticals in the copy questions, suggestions. We'll explain to writers changes we've made, anything of that sort. The second mode is what we call the editorial memo. And this is essentially a letter to the writer explaining the edits that we've made in a draft, giving them a high level sense of our impressions of the piece, what we thought the piece was about, what we think the strengths of the piece were, and where we think the piece could go. And then we lay out, you know, pretty systematically some questions and some feedback, and we make sure to tailor that to the writer's level, the writer's experience, and also the writer's literacy level. And so one of the things that our organization is doing, and this happens from the learning side of our operation, the education side of our operation, is trying to take seriously the levels of literacy behind bars. The vast majority of people who are incarcerated are functionally illiterate. They're reading and writing at a fourth grade level or lower. And if that is the case, then as an organization that, you know, specializes in journalism training and writing and reporting, we have to make sure that our training materials and our editing, our coaching is appropriate and realistically achievable for the level that our writers are at. So we take literacy into consideration and design materials with that in mind. We've got a very sophisticated learning operation that, you know, does the research and make sure that the language we're using is intelligible to a wide range of reading levels. I should say that literacy is not equated with IQ at all. So when I speak of literacy levels, I'm not talking about intelligence at all. Literacy is something that can be trained, that can be taught. And folks who suffer with literacy, more often than not, have simply not had access to high quality educational opportunities to learn that stuff. So that's another big part of our operation, is something we're trying to incorporate and think about all the time.
You do such really good work. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners? And again, I've been speaking with Mason Bryan, senior editor at the Prison Journalism Project.
Yeah, I just appreciate you taking the time, Doug, and being curious about our organization. I encourage listeners to check it out, prisonjournalismproject.org. If people have questions, if there are listeners who have loved ones or friends inside, or if you're listening from inside and you're interested at all in journalism and learning the craft of journalism, I encourage you to reach out. We are willing to work with anyone and everyone who has an enthusiasm for learning, an interest in journalism, and a desire to write about their experiences inside. So please don't hesitate to reach out.
Mason, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug. I really appreciate the time.
That was my conversation with Mason Bryan, senior editor at the Prison Journalism Project. Find them on the web at prisonjournalismproject.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I thank my guest, Mason Bryan, with the Prison Journalism Project, and thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it, and you make it all possible. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for Community Radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just so long. Intention.